Right, so we're all set ready now, because we're obviously 7 minutes late, so I'm going to have to pack in an awful lot into the next 50-odd minutes. Which is interesting, given that I'm using the topic of orality. And what we're going to spend some time doing is effectively talk you through some of the key thoughts that certainly Walter Olm put together with respect to orality, and really give you a few thoughts in terms of how things can be developed, how things can change, and maybe what we use in a contemporary situation is a combination of both print, online, and oral modes of communication. And we'll also talk about something which is particularly interesting called monk power. Anybody ever heard of monk power before? Oh, okay. Well, it comes from the notion that we talked about last week, where when, for instance, the Bible or equally important texts were being copied out by monks, you would effectively have basically one page per day produced on average. That's a page produced a day, and we'll look at some of the key changes that relates to that in a few moments. Okay, so key areas that we'll be looking at: what is it? Why is Walter Ong certainly seen as one of the key theorists in terms of discussing orality and how things are developing? How can we recognise it, other than just the spoken word? What are the characteristics that we see in terms of primary as opposed to secondary orality and so on? And also that line, consciousness and subjectivity in both orality and literacy. Because what we do over this week and next really is really cross the bridge in terms of how we communicate both orally and via the written word, and how that sort of impacts on ourselves as well. So let's start off with the first question: what do we mean by orality? And it's always good, even if you're writing an essay or anything, to actually start off by beginning to define your terms. And certainly if we're talking about primary orality, it's what I'm doing at this particular stage. In other words, the didactic approach, I'm talking about the range of things that we're covering. And orality relating to the spoken word ties in to literacy on the next level to equal what Ong would refer to as the technologizing of the word. It's the way in which the word actually is seen and developed. One book which is well worth accessing if you are interested in this thing is Bill Kovarik. It's Revolutions in Communications, published just last year, Media History from Gutenberg to the Digital Age. I've got a printout from this, which actually I will actually hand out to you now, because it ties in with a quiz question that I wanted to put together. So, if you look at the box that's actually in there, you can see the notions of monk power and the way in which things develop within the field, and ultimately this whole notion of the speeding up of what we've actually got. So, if back in the 1200s, or the 1300s, or the 1100s, or about 1,000 years ago, one monk would actually produce one handwritten page per day. Here's the first quiz question: what is Gutenberg's first name? Because it's always quite interesting when you talk about Gutenberg and various other things, but I always like to, when these guys have been working through the process, what's Gutenberg's first name? Johannes Gutenberg. Okay, well, Johannes Gutenberg effectively came along, and after several failed business ventures in which he was trying to make some kind of living, one of which actually entailed mirrors and other elements within that, he came up with the whole notion of movable print face type, which meant you could actually produce and mass produce things by simply moving letters which were put together in wood originally, and then obviously would come up later on to be metallicised, etc. And printing via the Gutenberg press, that's one of the reasons the Bible was there, one Gutenberg could be said to be the equivalent to 200 monk days. So effectively, one Gutenberg press could produce 200 times what one monk could produce in one day. So far, so wonderful, you might well say. Let's move on to the invention or the development of the steam press. John Walton, expect you to actually know the whole thing. John Walter, when he actually developed the steam press system, again, we then start moving into, well, mega numbers, 12 mega monks, 12 kilo monks, I should say, is the equivalent to one steam press. So you're producing by a steam press, where you've got that mechanisation, the technology that comes through there, the equivalent of 12,000 monk days. And so on and so forth. Joseph Pulitzer, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, who actually has the journalistic prize, the Pulitzer Prize, named after him, actually developed an even more high-speed press, which actually came up with 1 million monk days. And Vannevar, who was an early proponent of computer engineering and so on, is actually Vannevar Bush, his full name. He actually sort of developed the whole notion of, again, six times a megabunk. So again, speed is one of the the rapidity of the way things are going. There's a lot of stuff that's out there. It's a big change from the notion of how do you actually develop that stuff? What do you use that stuff for? Is it good? Is it material which effectively sort of impacts on the whole thing? Or do we actually get, as Ong referred to in the 1980s, to this whole notion of, again, the technologizing of the words, that actually somehow we are missing the point when we start talking about, you know, how we learn, how do we develop? Talk about blended learning, images that come through that whole system. That's his book, if you're interested in accessing it from the library, Orality and Literacy. Because the two things tend to go hand in hand. We actually carry that through the whole notion of reading and writing. You normally would expect people to read, who would be able to read, probably to be able to write as well. Two things, again, dovetail into place from that sort of side of things. So what are the key ideas that Ong came up with, if we wanted to have the sort of summation of the whole thing? Well, the first idea, he came up with 3,000 ideas. Are we going to spend this particular session going through 3,000 ideas from Ong? What would your response be? Probably that. No, of course not. I want to sort of pull out some of the key areas and elements within that. One of his key ideas is summed up in this question. Does what we see somehow separate us from things? Clearly, if you're visually impaired or impacted on this, again, there's a whole range of things on that system. But going back to that whole ancient Chinese line that we have two ears and one mouth, so we should technically do twice as much listening as speaking. Could be something to do with stereoscopic vision of sound as well. But it's what key things we're looking to develop and see and relate to. Talked last week about Chinese whispers and the way in which that can actually change and be misinformed and so on. And Ong's major characteristic, one of his key lines, is that we don't get to the stage whereby people tell lies. And information becomes disinformation or misinformation. Again, key characteristic is of primary orality. It is evanescent. That word I mentioned last week about evanescence. Things tend to fade away. If you try to think back to what you were doing when you were 11 or 12, you might be able to remember certain key points, but you certainly won't be able to give an accurate, completely photographic memory-oriented link of the whole system unless it was actually recorded. The mind doesn't work on that basis. This is the clear element or characteristic of orality. You're reinforcing what I'm saying by taking notes. These slides are also available via Blackboard. Yay, it's working! So you can download the thing and again use it as an additional add-on to what we're saying. You can obviously read through the photocopy that I've actually given you, which again talks about systems from this. But if you were just relying on what I was saying, most psychological surveys would suggest that you go away remembering maybe 5%. And that, if I asked you again the same thing tomorrow, or asked you, well, tell me about evanescence or various other things, again, that might drop even further. Because again, there is that notion, there's a lot of distractions, lots of other areas within that, and the notion that Ong put forward when he talks about evanescence is that things eventually will gradually disappear from memory. If a culture is based on orality as its prime mechanism for communication, you constantly need to be repeating it. How did people used to do that in the medieval times? They sang songs, balladeers, pop songs, the equivalent of actually going from town to town singing about things. Because the way in which we remember things can be assisted by a number of techniques. Richard of York gave battles in vain. What's that relating to? The rainbow, exactly. How do we know that? Because red, orange, red, yellow, etc. It's one of those mnemonics that helps us remember. Otherwise, if we just try to remember, mind doesn't work like that. You kind of need to focus on key pictures and images to remember what's happening, to kind of keep bringing it back, to keep actually ensuring that it's there. It's repetition. In contemporary political terms, that's why most politicians will say things three times. Or, in presentations, you say what you're going to say, you say it, and then you say what you've said. So you go through those three areas of saying it, doing a precy, saying the whole thing, and then summing up. And actually, we use a similar technique when it comes to lectures as well, in terms of the actual areas that are there for. And the key element with respect to Ong is this big question, that if you can't write it down, if you haven't got clay tablets or a printing press or pens or any other ways to actually write things down, where do you actually store that knowledge? Yeah, we have a society where so much is stored in the cloud now, which is fine, it's all up there. But if we have a massive power cut or other areas, you might sort of think, well, where do we go? How do we connect with that? You know, let's go back to that other book, Vannevar, 6 megabucks. A Wozniak. Anybody know what Wozniak's first name is and what he actually did? Why is so-and-so Wozniak such an important person? He's still alive as well, actually. He worked quite closely with a man called Jobs. Steve Wozniak actually came up with the first design for the PC. So there's the line from that sort of perspective. Hence the little clue there, desktop publishing. That's around from there. Let's move into a different medium. Because we've talked about print quite extensively. One of the things about communication and society as we head through the next few weeks is we obviously talk about other media forms as well. And Sarnoff there, whose name was actually David, was one of the key folk at the beginning of the 20th century, together with Marconi, who saw the tremendous opportunities that were provided, was being provided, by the telegraph moving into radio transmission, moving into sound. Radio, as I said, is very much an oral, primary oral medium. And if a picture is worth 1,000 words, well, clearly, if you're looking at radio and television, suddenly there's masses and masses of information that's coming through. You think about, you go to the cinema, you go to see stuff on your iPad or various other things, the amount of images that are constantly being sent through the system, it's amazing, we don't go crazy, maybe we are. How do we actually sort of process what's being said? How do we select? How do we filter? How do we work through that? And hopefully you all know who Mr. Berners-Lee is, first name. Tim Berners-Lee, the chap who actually came up with the World Wide Web. And look at that, look at the sort of numbers that's actually there. 1.3 million websites and posts per day. And that was about 10 months ago, so it's probably gone up to about 1.8 million websites and posts per day from that sort of side of things. If you're looking for a spare penny, you might find that Mr. Brin might well be sort of accessing. Worth contacting Sergey Brin. He's actually the 12th richest man in the world. Why do you think that is? What did Sergey Brin actually do? Or sort of put together this century? Something which ends in E. Yes, he was one of the co-founders of Google. Nice little number. Yeah. So switching from that sort of perspective from, you know, the 600 years or so ago, and Johannes Gutenberg, who actually almost died a pauper. He didn't, in the end, they managed to realise, because he had various bankruptcy and lines from that perspective. But you're still talking about this whole notion of storage, knowledge, and elements relating to that. As we say, how much can a brain fit in itself? How much can a bear of little mind or little brain actually focus through? Nobody really knows, but again, it's not so much how much can you store, but how much can you recall? Yeah, it's one of the reasons why there's constantly in education the debate between you should give much more final exams. No, the whole thing should be an exam. No, it should. How do you relate to that? If you cram for an exam, how much do you actually remember? How much of that knowledge is actually of use post the exam? Yes, algebra, geometry, trigonometry, calculus, all fascinating ways of working, but unless you're necessarily working in a field which uses them, so you're going to sort of appreciate why you kind of need to memorise key things like that, but it's still an important element. And as I always say, one of the key things, though, about the mind, and again preventing Alzheimer's or the sort of things impacting, is how do you keep your mind active? Is it through a constant stimuli? Or does constant stimuli simply relate to overstimulus and eventually you sort of desensitize? Very important when you start choosing what images you're using in any campaign. There are lots of companies that have got a lot of negative publicity from using images that effectively weren't appropriate, or that maybe were too resonant of shock tactics, including, say, government areas. You know, let's consider the anti-smoking. Here we are in the middle of Stoptober. Do you use shock adverts to actually sort of prevent people smoking? Do you say, is that sort of impact? Drink driving? All ways in which, again, you're looking at how do you influence society, how do you connect together on the whole thing. And one of the early sort of campaigns in terms of seatbelt driving was "Can't click every trip," which was a catchphrase of a chap you may have heard of, sadly, called Jimmy Savile. Had to strap people in, obviously, but anyway, it's another line entirely. But actually, choice of celebrity, not necessarily the best way forward. Ong also talks about what he refers to as aggregative formulae. Ways in which things can connect together, the ways in which we make these connections, ways in which we can actually sort of ensure that we can remember things from that. And his notion of aggregative formulae is basically defined as something which is homeostatic. Homeostatic actually comes from a biological term meaning maintaining balance. There's actually a French biologist and natural scientist called Claude Bernard who came up with Le Milieu Intérieur. He was talking about the inner side of human beings and what goes on in our bodies, which kind of ensure that our levels of acidity and alkalinity are all perfect, and there's feedback that develops there. In other words, it's what maintains the conditions necessary for life. And actually the term feedback loop, closing the loop, ensuring that sort of what's comes through all emerges from that notion of homeostasis. Stasis basically meaning the same, and again homeostatic, tying into constant similarity to that sort of thing. Worth considering Inglis's quote from the last century here, actually, because he's talking about what Ong has been writing about when we come up with this term, the homeostatic society. Yes, it's come from biology, it's been appropriated, it's used for that sort of thing. But again, just have a look at that sort of line of things and consider what Inglis is actually referring to. In other words, somebody says something at one particular period that will then be transmitted verbally to somebody else. Maybe a bit like Chinese whispers, that will work through this. Did you hear this? We're talking gossip, we're talking about ways in which things are developed. The challenge, of course, is that when it comes to this form of communication, it's slow. One of the elements about Ong's work when it comes to the oral society is he would, in essence, be referring to the way in which news used to be transmitted from village to village, from town to town. Street criers. you still occasionally get street criers. They usually wheeled out on important days, like Grimsby playing a 0-0 draw with Lincoln, so everybody's happy. You probably have a town crier to work through that process. But in terms of that whole sort of sequence, it's a way in which the news was developed, and often used in verse. You know, the news was delivered in verse and put up in verse. In a primary oral culture, you could also go through the streets of Lincoln and so on, or any other sort of city or major town, and you wouldn't actually see printed signs, you would see symbols. You know, rather like the red and white stripes of a barbershop, which again sort of symbolise the blood and things that would actually work through, but also a slaughterhouse as well, the twin balls of a pauper's house, or a pawn shop and so on. Again, ways in which you'd have simplicity there. Now, you could argue that actually we're kind of coming full circle, and there is an article I'd like you to have a read through, which is accessible via Blackboard, which was produced in 1997 by Tom Wilson at Sheffield, which talks about the future of the book. Does it have one in the case of electronic publishing and so on? But ultimately, if you look up to what Inglis is actually saying there, one of the challenges with respect to this is that bits get lost. Yeah, everybody in this room is made up of four bases of deoxyribonucleic acid combining in some way, shape or form. Adenine, guanine, thymine and cytosine. Amazing, really. But there's also, in terms of the genetic library, bits that sometimes are used, bits that aren't used, bits that are switched on. It's the same with language. Language changes, language evolves, words come into fashion, words drop out of fashion, there are reasons, there are rationales, and so on. Interestingly enough, you look at the terms white and black, and the way they are actually used, anybody who was a brunette would be referred to as black in a kind of pre-1600 version. Interesting. You see sort of various other sort of bits and pieces within the field there. But again, different areas. Gay has changed its sort of time substantially in the last 30, 40 years. You can go back and read detective stories and you can actually read about Simon Templar being a dashing gay young blade around town. Totally different meaning to, you know, what we actually have and so on. Okay. Here's quiz number one. Right. Jenny. Welcome to Jenny, everybody. What were the four objects I just showed you? I think I've been put on the spot in the first session, is there, Ian? What were the four objects?
Four objects?
Yes. Christine. Yes, that was one.
Sunglasses.
Right.
And then makeup, I can't remember the name, called something.
Cuddly toy? Christine?
There was like a wine bottle.
Alright. Anybody got the fourth one?
Select?
Oh, saucepan. We've had the saucepan of water. Let's just sort of congratulate ourselves and so on. Saucepan, glass of water, bottle, and sunglasses. But again, you know, here we are, 30 minutes in, suddenly these images are slashed out. I don't think any preparation, I don't say, think, oh, we're actually looking at sort of things through. And that's one example in a sense of very rapid sort of how do you sort of walk through that? How do you connect together? How do you sort of relate to those particular elements? Well, one way in which you can remember it is you construct a storyline. You construct a narrative. In other words, you kind of think of the craziest things to relate to, some spectacles, a saucepan, a bottle of water, and a glass which might not have fizzy water in it or whatever. You think memorable thoughts. You kind of impact the notion of how things are working through that. Also, bear in mind the thing that I've been talking about with all primary orality is that it involves a certain amount of redundancy. Redundancy can be everything from starting sentences off with, so what we're going to do now is, so we'll do this. Just listen, if you study political radio interviews or any interviews with experts, and how often they say, so. It's a bit like the equivalent of, and so on. In other words, thinking time. This is more about life and world-based. it helps if you've got a commonality and a common currency and a common range of experiences to actually apply to things that you actually are seeing. It's often said that one of the issues with the Native Americans in Columbus's time was they didn't actually see the ships because they had no previous conception for what the ships were actually about. Interesting line on that, isn't it? But you also need to ground it in terms of concrete language knowledge. When things are written down and they're printed, somehow it makes them appear a little bit more real than when we just speak about them. I've already talked about homeostasis and homeostatic, but also usually you find that in order to make sense, there's some kind of operational logic that works through. So there's an intrinsic logic in terms of how we think, how we see things going. Swans are based in Lincoln, swans do this, swans do that, and so on and so forth. Anybody know who he was? Ancient Greek scholar. Talked about quite some time. And you know. What? No? Not Galileo, no, long after. Well, I suppose you could say he inspired Galileo after a fashion, because he certainly spoke his mind. Although he didn't believe that slavery is perfectly acceptable, because that was the way that the Greeks operated at the time. Plato. So, again, and as I said, being a disciple of Socrates. I mean, actually, although technically he was against writing things down, as indeed his tutor Socrates was, had he not actually written things down, we wouldn't actually have had any Greek philosophy or any Greek sort of analysis to apply today to the present work that we actually do on certainly the whole notion, as we looked at last week, of the Renaissance. It's unlikely whether it would have happened. There's a flaw in the argument. Plus, of course, that notion that, you know, a society which couldn't see that actually slavery was improper was perhaps questionable from that point of view. But either way, you come back to this whole notion of consciousness and subjectivity in orality and literacy, which you can actually sum up in one kind of short phrase. It's in the eye of the beholder. One person's view of a sporting incident can be completely different from another person's view. I did a piece this morning, actually, with the Lieutenant General of Louisiana, on the back of, obviously, did anybody watch any American football fans here? Who saw the 20-0 victory of the New Orleans Saints against Miami Dolphins at Wembley? Because, obviously, more American football, if you haven't Wembley, the better it is for everybody, really, the whole world. I'm being deliberately provocative here, but you know, one day it'll come to Grimsby, you mark my words. But ultimately, the reason I actually mention that story is because it does depend on who the storyteller is. What message do they actually have? Are people ever totally objective? Or is there always a kind of hidden agenda? Is there a way which would, so from my point of view, I try as far as possible in the tutorial session to be as objective as possible. And one of the key things we say to all students when you're writing your essays or developing that is maintain your objectivity. Because it's too easy to slip and say, well, I think this, I do that, etc. Whereas you need to maintain an objectivity throughout and be conscious of maintaining that objectivity. Be aware, be self-aware of where things are actually slipping and so on and so forth. So again, when you're talking about visiting Louisiana, apparently there are more and more people actually choosing to visit the swamps because there's so much fun things to do. They will give you guided tours of not only where Hollywood has actually had people being shot and adventures like Live and Let Die and James Bond, etc., but it'll actually show you where people were, where real people have been shot. Bonnie and Clyde said, great, can you bring your own guns? Fantastic. All sorts of other areas there in terms of what's coming across. Now, you know, run from a present-day experience, you have the the Louisiana Tourist Board wanting to lock into the adventure of the New Orleans Saints, taking part in what was regarded as probably one of the worst games of North American football that Britain has ever seen, because it was actually 0-0 at half-time, and they scored, they won 20-0 at the end. But the rationale is, you have the two connections. You're sort of doing a piece on tourism in Louisiana, fed through the medium of radio, that's now going to be going out into podcasts and various other elements, and you're getting the message out there in a, you know, range of sort of ways. And this particular chap, Lieutenant General, Tom, it's tied in with that much, so I'll bring that back and play it to you tomorrow, actually, because it'll be up and edited from that sort of point of view. It's using a primary oral medium, it's using radio. Literacy, well, I got a press release, so I said, fine, okay, I'll have to cover that. Did it back. 9 a.m. this morning. But also you're conscious that actually there are lines that you could take there which could critique the American ideology in terms of guns, in terms of gun control, in terms of lack of gun control, and a whole stack of other things that are actually there. Y'all come back now, you hear? Okay, so let's just sum up the sort of key things that we've actually talked about in terms of orality, etc. And let's hopefully return to Blackboard to actually do that. Well, if you were to actually ask what were Ong's key ideas, he really was pushing the notion of primary orality above everything else. It's the spoken word, it's the way in which the spoken word is transmitted through society. So it focuses on that particular aspect. It also ties in with the notion of crossing over with literacy and seeing it as something which should be used in parallel with literacy, as opposed to something which opposes it completely. I don't think Ong's ever really necessarily gone on record as saying that he was totally against the notion of literacy. Obviously not, otherwise he wouldn't have written a book, would he? A bit ironic from that sort of point of view. But as I've hopefully sort of developed, as we've sort of jumped through a whole range of things, and before we start talking about the radio next week and literacy and so on, and that impact on technology, those are the sort of key areas that really are quite worthwhile looking at and considering from the perspective of how things develop, change and adjust and so on. And all this without a single YouTube channel schedule at all. So, if I move to the Blackboard system of learning materials, you'll see that actually I've put in the preparation for week 3 print. And, because I'm just a caring, cheering person, I thought, well, Blackboard might not be working. I've also printed these out. So what we're asking you to do for, actually not tomorrow's seminar, but next week's seminar, is to think a little bit about how print actually operates, and also what Brian Winston has actually been talking about within that field as well. Because Brian, as well as being one of our very own university fine folk, is also sort of committed to jotting down the whole issues of print and elements as well. So you've got an aspect of that. And the other element that I wanted to talk about was this one here, which is something, if you get a chance to read it tomorrow, by all means print it out if you wish, but it is, you can read it online, it's about 89, it's about 20 pages. This is, as I say, the electronic publishing and the future of the book element, which is just going around now. And if you have a chance to read that, I'd like to you to look at that from next time. Don't you? Oh, that's it there. Okay, so it's also going to be the sort of first substantial paper there. Okay. It's worth noting as well that opening sentence. It is a brave person who can claim to talk with assurance about the future of anything, since the future is fundamentally unknowable. It's kind of a bit of a variation on Samuel Goldwyn when he was asked about what's the success in the motion picture industry. He was one of the founders with Louis B. Mayer of Metro Goldwyn Mayer Productions, and he said, "Nobody knows nothing." Which is grammatically a bit dodgy, but at the same time. Wilson goes on to talk about how the death of the book is actually working. This, as you say, is written 20 years ago. And what I'd like you to do is have a read through the death of the book and really ask yourself, I'll talk a bit more about what I spoke about last week in terms of ARPANET, the military lines of things, how the internet developed, how that sort of impacted, etc. I'd like you to basically be prepared to spend just 2 or 3 minutes just chatting about one of the sort of aspects that really appeals to you from what we've done so far. So that's either oral history, or it could be something relating to monk power, which proved to be very popular last year, actually. Anyone who's interested in this, yeah, I just find it quite interesting. And that notion from Sergei Brin, that if you go all the way back to when a monk was writing one handwritten page per day, here we have the equivalent of one Brin with Google, etc., 2.8 billion Google searches per day. It's a little wonder he's the 12th richest person in the world. Do you know how much he's worth? A mere 45 billion. That's all. Sergei Brin, originally born in Russia, and migrated and again sort of connected together and defined the whole notion of launching Google, say, back in the last decade of the last century. So, anybody got any questions or queries at this stage about what I've talked about in terms of orality and what that sort of relates to and how it connects together? Let's go back to the thing from there as we sort of have moved out of lecture one into orality. And so it's so mind-blowing, you thought, I wish I was back doing my practical stuff. Do you have Chris Chowan, by the way? Or is it Sam Badu?
Chris.
Yeah, you've got to actually say to Chris, actually, Chris, we have to get out at 10 to 12 to enable us to get here, because he does tend to... I mean, having said that, it also means that Rupert Hilliard, one of the English tutors, is here. I mean, I can't really sort of go in because there's nobody else there. Anyway, I think we made quite good time today, actually. I'm actually packing quite a lot. Any other questions? All happy? Excellent, yes.
Do we often get these books out to read?
The article is online, okay? So that's all you need to do is access that via Blackboard. Which is the article for the print book future. Okay, that's what I want you to do for tomorrow. Next week, for Brian Winston, think of that. Yes, you would need to actually access Brian Winston's book from the library. Okay, but go to the library; they've got lots of copies of Brian's book, which is The Liberty to Know: Messages for Expression Media in the West from Gutenberg to Google. And depending on the edition, you might have a different sort of page number, but roughly it's the first chapter, really. Just have a look through that. And what I'd actually quite like you to do is basically, for tomorrow, choose one of those four that you're going to look at and research in more detail for the seminar next week. Okay? So it's like one of the four sort of key things there. I mean, I don't get too much over that sort of things, because as you can see next week, sneak preview, in fact, if you wanted to. Pause there, you can go all the way back there, including when we actually start showing you videos and various other sort of elements there. But week three, which is the print lecture, open that. I mean, always assuming Blackboard doesn't go down again, but you know, we've all been told it's all there, and there you can see the notion of the impact of print and some of the areas that we have, including not Sergei Eisenstein, but Elizabeth Eisenstein and her novel, The Printing Press, not novel, her book, The Printing Press as an Agent of Change. Okay. Anything else?
My Blackboard still hasn't updated.
Well, good news. The good news, Jenny, is it was literally 1.5 hours ago, 90 minutes, where I finally emailed and signed off on the electronic system that you've now been officially welcomed to the course, and it is confirmed. So, fingers crossed, you should be, by the end of the day, able to access. Yeah, you should have that, because I've now officially welcomed you to the course, and accepted it, of course. If you don't, simply, well, let me know by tomorrow and I'll give you this as a hard copy so you can take away with it. Alright? I'll do that now just in case I'm going to redo this. Any other things? All happy? Have a read through the article on. Future of the book,
yes.
Which is the this one, this one, print book future. Okay, that's for tomorrow. The book, yeah, the other one is for next week.
And for next week, you just pick one of the four?
Yes. Because I'll talk about the stuff at the